From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington bureau chief for Al Jazeera TV. And here are the issues. The Tunisian man suspected in the terrorist attack at a Christmas market in Berlin was shot to death Friday by police in Italy. In Ankara, the Russian ambassador to Turkey was killed by a gunman who shouted his anger over Russia's military intervention in the fighting in Syria. Russia backs the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad. Russia, Iran, and Turkey met in Moscow to work toward a political accord to end the war in Syria. The United States was not invited. And President-elect Donald Trump neared completion of nominees for his cabinet. Well, Abdi, I'll start with you. What should we think about this Tunisian man who seemed to wander all over Europe, even though he was known to the Germans and others? He was on the U.S. no-fly list. He was known to have had a relationship with some of these militant Islamic groups, and yet he seemed to be free to roam around Europe.
It seems to me that there are many complexities and ironies in this case. You've pointed out some of them. Another one is the fact that he's Tunisian. Tunisia was the spark to the so-called Arab Spring, which was supposed to transform not just the region, but the region's relations with parts of the world such as Europe, which is right there, just across the water. The risk that he highlights is a risk that obviously we are very familiar with by now, and that's the risk of radicalization. What are the roots of radicalization in the region? There are obviously many. You alluded in your introduction, you mentioned Turkey, you mentioned Syria, you have Libya, you have Egypt. But the fact of the situation is that the Europeans are right there, close to a region which seems to be volatile and which seems to be set to become even more volatile now.
Yeah, Barbara, what do you make of this whole situation?
Well, I think it's interesting, the profile of the young man, Anis Amri. He's very similar to those who staged attacks in France and in Belgium, in the sense that these are not people who have deep roots in religion. They're mostly petty criminals, young people who could not find their way. If you look at the history of this young man, he came from a family of, I think, five sisters and four brothers. He's the youngest. He got into trouble in Tunisia for stealing a car. He fled to Italy, and he got in trouble with the law there. He set fire to some sort of refugee center and wound up spending 4 years in six different jails before he turned up in Germany. He clearly did not have a deep connection to religion, but he was someone who was frustrated, who was alienated. The Italians tried to deport him, but failed to be able to do it. Tunisia wouldn't take him back. And then the Germans were prepared to deport him, but he was waiting on a Tunisian passport, which only arrived, I think, very recently. So The problem in these cases is that you have thousands of these people wandering around Europe. Many of them have gotten into trouble with the law, but not into serious trouble. They're under surveillance, but there isn't enough probable cause to arrest them until they commit an atrocity like the one that occurred in Berlin.
Well, wasn't he radicalized in prison, however, and did family send him religious texts and so on?
It's kind of ambiguous. I mean, there are different reports, and of course, since he's been killed, we'll never really know.
Yes.
What provoked him to do it. It could be just simply anger at European society for not giving him citizenship or asylum, not giving him a job. We really won't know.
Well, what about this question of that he couldn't be deported? I mean, it looks like the Germans and other countries in Europe are handcuffed.
I'm not that well versed into the intricacies of German law or Italian law, but what is clear is that this adds another bucket to the sea of conversation, angry conversation going on now in Europe about the European Union and open borders and, you know, what the whole connection to the various crises in the Middle East, Syria, Libya, and elsewhere are actually doing to the whole institution of the European Union. Why was he able to roam around freely? I'm sure this is now a question that will be fore and center in the conversation, not just in Italy and Germany, but throughout Europe. I just wanted to add that while we still don't know all the details of what actually happened with this man, how he exactly got radicalized, we know for sure that there's, again, a lot of angry conversation going on in Europe about him, people like him, why they're being radicalized, what governments in Europe have done or not done to deal with a situation like that, to counter the influence of ISIS and like-minded groups. And all this is happening in a context where the right, and sometimes the extreme right, seems to be gaining a lot of influence in many European countries.
And particularly in Germany.
Yeah, well, Angela Merkel faces re-election. There are a lot of concerns that she will be defeated because of this particular incident, but also because she allowed in so many Syrian refugees. But we should point out, this was not a Syrian refugee who'd been given asylum in Germany. Mm-hmm. This was somebody who'd gotten in through other means. And I think that's very important to say, especially, I know we're going to talk about Aleppo, but, you know, especially as the situation in Syria gets more and more desperate.
Well, speaking of Aleppo, let's turn to the Middle East. But let's start with the assassination of the Russian ambassador to Turkey, which was really quite amazing. You could just, I'm sure many of us have seen the video of he's standing there giving a speech and he's shot in the back. What should we make of this, Barbara?
Yeah, well, Turkey, as would be predicted, blamed it on the Gulen movement. They blame everything on the Gulen movement, this movement led by a former ally of the president of Turkey, now his sworn enemy, Fethullah Gulen. But
He lives in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. But in fact, it seems, I mean, to the extent we know, and again, the Turkish police shot this guy dead. I mean, they could have probably subdued him and gotten some more information about him, but they shot him dead. It's entirely possible, given what he yelled, I mean, he yelled, you know, don't forget Aleppo, don't forget Syria, that he was simply absolutely overtaken by emotion because of what we've witnessed coming out of Aleppo. I mean, the Russians and the Syrians and the Iranians, but particularly the Russians with their bombing, have turned Aleppo into Dresden. They pulverized the place such that finally the remaining people living there had to flee. And Turkey has been a very emotional supporter of the Sunni Muslims in Turkey, of various rebel groups. And if you have to watch this every day, I mean, Americans, you know, somehow avert their eyes from this, but the Turks are watching it. They have refugees who've come, millions of them, and it's entirely possible that this young man was simply trying to avenge the massacre in Aleppo.
I think he was 22 years old, Abdi, something like that. He was a policeman, and it's just one of the most gripping pieces of video that I've seen in a long time.
I mean, it really is extraordinary in every aspect of it, what happened in Ankara. The fact that the Russian, the ambassador of a major country, who happened to be talking about the love of the Turks for Russia and for the Russians, and suddenly gets killed right there and then. And the other extraordinary thing is that in normal circumstances, you get the ambassador of a country killed, shot dead. That country would possibly invade the country where the ambassador was shot. But we are not in that situation now. Remember how Vladimir Putin reacted when the Turks, when was it, a couple of years ago, shot down a Russian military aircraft in Turkish territory. The anger of the reaction by Putin, the reaction to the killing of the ambassador, is a far, far cry from that, because the situation has dramatically changed in relations between Turkey and Russia. But I think overall, it just highlights yet again the extreme volatility of the Middle East as a whole, but also the real dangerous waters where Turkey now seems to be swimming in connection to the situation in neighboring Syria.
I have a question involving the Russians. Is their role, is their military role in Syria, is it indispensable for the Assad government? I mean, are the Russians...
Yes. I mean, Assad government was struggling, and then until the Russian military intervention, which has now put all of what they call useful Syria, the main population centers of Syria, back under the control of the Assad regime. It's been a very successful intervention on the part of Putin, and has changed the whole character of this conflict. Turkey, which is a NATO ally, although it's hard to remember that sometimes, has been obliged, really, to deal with Russia now because its options have changed in Syria. It's no longer hoping to overthrow Assad, which was the Turkish goal for a long time. Now they just want to make sure that the Kurds in Syria don't form their own large autonomous area. And so they've made a pact with Putin, I think, to keep that from happening. And that's their main priority now.
You know, I find it really interesting that the Obama administration has for years now been saying that there is no military solution to the situation in Syria. Well, to the Russians, there is. I mean, the fact that they've undertaken to help Bashar regain control over the biggest city in Syria, the most important city in Syria commercially. Clearly, to them, to the Russians and to Bashar al-Assad, there is a military solution to the situation. But then again, you look at what happened to the Russian ambassador in Turkey, and you look at where the rebels seem to have moved to from Aleppo. You look at where ISIS, having re-established control over Palmyra in Syria, and you wonder, well, is the Obama administration right in saying that there's no military solution to the situation in Syria? We won't know, but we know for sure that to the Russians and to Bashar al-Assad, they do think there is a military solution.
We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me today are Barbara Slavin, correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and Abdurraheen Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera TV. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. This program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Famously, Barbara, President Obama said that the Russians, in intervening, were going to get into a quagmire, and that up until more recently, it hasn't looked like a quagmire for the Russians, but maybe they're headed in that direction. I don't see how they can withdraw.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the question is, how do you keep Assad in power? Because there are still thousands of rebels. They're concentrated in places like Idlib, where a lot of these people from Aleppo have fled. There's also still ISIS, which, while the Aleppo operation was going on, went back into Palmyra, an ancient Roman city in Syria, and apparently seized a lot of tanks and equipment. The battle against ISIS is going very slowly in Iraq and Mosul. Raqqa is still under control of ISIS. So this is by no means over. I think the reason the United States is no longer sort of seen as pivotal to what's going on right now is everybody's waiting for President Trump to see what his position is going to be. Is he going to sit down with Putin and, you know, divide up the Middle East a la Sykes-Picot, or what is the deal going to be? And, you know, Obama's very much a lame duck, and of course Secretary John Kerry, who's worked so hard on the issue, also really is not relevant in the last few weeks of the Obama administration to the situation.
Would you agree then, Abdi, that the Russians can't withdraw? In other words, they may have a military victory, but they're going to have to stay there to maintain Assad in power.
All the signs are there that the Russians will have to stay, although from their point of view, I'm not sure if that's necessarily a bad thing from their point of view. Syria is extremely important to them, regardless of who is the president and regardless of how much territory the president, in this case, President Bashar al-Assad, actually controls in Syria. But in terms of access to the Mediterranean and in terms of Russian ambition to actually do even bigger things and better things from their point of view, not just in Syria, but throughout the Middle East, I'm not sure that, you know, being stuck in Syria is necessarily a bad thing for them. It's obviously a bad thing for Syria itself. I mean, if you look at what the Russians have done in Aleppo, militarily, they've helped Bashar al-Assad achieve a victory. But when you look at the scale of damage that's been done to a place like Aleppo, it really looks like a Pyrrhic victory. Then what? Now you have
control. Who's going to rebuild?
Who's going to rebuild it? Are the Russians going to be asked to build it? Are they willing to build it? Are they capable of building it? You know, all these are very big questions. And just to circle back to what Barbara said earlier, I mean, the battle for Aleppo, we're not even sure that the rebels may not decide to come back to Aleppo at some point and start another day in the fight. But let's assume that Bashar al-Assad has tightened his grip over Aleppo, then we're still looking for signs that the situation in Syria militarily is done, and those signs are not there.
Is there a role for the U.S. in the short run here, Barbara? Not invited to that meeting in Moscow, which I doubt will lead to an end in the Syrian war.
Well, the humanitarian aid. I mean, that's what we're pretty much reduced to. The United States has been the biggest contributor of humanitarian aid to Syrians inside and outside the country. It would be great if we could take some more Syrian refugees before Trump's wall goes up. Or his ban on Muslims, or whatever it is that he's touting these days. That's the way that we can help these people. More than half the population has been displaced by this war. It's just incredible.
There was a piece a few days ago in the Wall Street Journal by Michael O'Hanlon, who's with the Brookings Institution, and he's touted it as a Trump strategy to end Syria's nightmare.
Really?
And that's a bit of a stretch, but anyway, I'll read you a couple of sentences from his piece. It said, President-elect Trump has stated that his priority in Syria will be to work with Russian President Vladimir Putin to hasten the defeat of ISIS. Any attempt to push Mr. Assad out of power would be deferred. In Jordan, as I learned on a recent trip, many see this approach as more realistic than trying to defeat ISIS while simultaneously expediting Mr. Assad's ouster. Is that?
That's Obama's policy. There's nothing new in that.
Well, the point that O'Hanlon says is that, well, you're not trying to do both of them at the same time.
We're not.
Yeah, I think a statement like that, or an analysis like that, quite frankly, simplifies the situation in the complexity of the situation in Syria. Because while ISIS was the effect of the cause initially, we agree ISIS is now both the effect and the cause of many of the problems in Syria. But you have to remember that one of the dangerous side effects of what's been going on in Syria is the sectarian issue. And many Sunnis, not just in Syria, but also in neighboring Iraq, while they may not wholeheartedly agree with what ISIS is doing, they certainly look around and they say, the world has given up on us. And these guys, you know, they may be brutal, they may be horrible, but they bring the issue of the Sunnis to the forefront on the international radar. You may agree with that, you may disagree with it, but the sectarian divide, I'm not sure this particular analysis, how far it would go in solving the sectarian divide, and therefore I'm not sure how much Donald Trump can actually hope to solve the situation in Syria, no matter what he does with the Russians.
Do you want to add anything to
that? Yeah, no, that's what Obama's done. I mean, in effect, you know, Obama made a huge mistake by saying Assad must go without having any strategy to push him out. But de facto, since the rise of ISIS, U.S. policy has changed dramatically, and the focus is on ISIS. It's not on Assad. I mean, the United States was preparing to even work with the Russians against ISIS until a couple of months ago. And, you know, it may be that Trump will simply revive that plan, but I agree with Abdurrahim, it's not going to solve the crisis in Syria.
Well, let's talk about Donald Trump in a moment. And what you referred to, he could have a meeting very early on with Vladimir Putin. What is conceivable that they could come up with?
Well, I'm sure Putin will want to trade an end to U.S. support for sanctions over Ukraine for something else. So what is that something else? I mean, only Vladimir Putin knows. It could have to do with Syria. It could have to do with the Iran nuclear deal. What will he put on the table? I don't know. And given how erratic and ill-informed the comments and tweets of Trump have been lately, I'm not sure he understands the magnitude of what's at stake. And that really worries me.
Abdi?
It seems to me that from everything that Vladimir Putin has said up to date here, obviously he has a much better disposition towards Trump than he does towards Obama. And the feeling is so far mutual. Donald Trump also seems to be happy to be working with Donald Trump in, you know, some sort of honeymoon. I'm not sure, given the complexity of the international situation that both Trump and Putin will have to deal with, given Russia's ambitions in places like the Middle East, for example, I'm not sure that in a year's time, the honeymoon between Trump and Putin, if there is a honeymoon, would still be in existence by then.
Yeah, I certainly wonder about that. Let's turn to Trump's nomination of an oil man from Texas as his Secretary of State. My qualms about it are just that you would have two people rather than one who really don't have any experience in foreign policy. You know, making oil deals around the world isn't quite the same thing.
No, I'm going to surprise you, Fred. I'm actually hearing good things about Rex Tillerson.
Well, I've heard them too, but I still have qualms.
From senior diplomats who've met him. I mean,
really?
He's gone and, you know, he's gone all around the world negotiating for ExxonMobil. He's met many leaders in the world. He has good people who've advised him on risk analysis and a lot of these countries. His knowledge of Russia, I think, is a plus because he knows where the bodies are buried, and there are a lot of them. He knows some of the most disreputable people in the Russian government, including the head of Rosneft, their big mega oil and gas consortium run by a guy named Igor Sechin, who is quite frightening, and a close buddy, of course, of Vladimir Putin. So I think that's a plus. I've also heard that he has put his foot down and will not allow John Bolton to be the Deputy Secretary of State, which is excellent news, if true. He wants somebody who will have the respect of the State Department to actually run the department. Now, that's on the plus side. On the negative side, there have been worrisome demands by the transition team to a number of cabinet agencies. At the State Department, they seem to want to know who works on women's issues and what are the programs that are devoted to women's issues. And I have a great fear that, you know, Trump will come in trying to cut many of the signature programs on gender equality, climate change, many other things that have been really important to Obama over the last 8 years. But Tillerson himself apparently gets good marks for being intelligent, thoughtful, and somebody who actually does know the world.
I am surprised that.
Well, I wanted to be a little counterintuitive.
Well, you were.
Yeah, not everything he does is bad.
I think Trump is trying to be counterintuitive almost at every turn. Look, when Mitt Romney's name was mentioned, at least outside the United States, you know, there were some question marks raised about his experience, but there was also quite a bit of enthusiasm for having him. But in a place like the Middle East, for example, the name that really got people's attention was David Petraeus, because, you know, he served in Iraq, he knows the language, he knows the culture, the customs, and so on. But it seems to me that because the DNA, or an important part of the DNA of the Trump administration, is business, Trump himself is a businessman, it seems to me that part of the focus of his policy will be on business and trade. And, you know, within that logic, Tillerson obviously makes a lot of sense. And, you know, as Barbara said, he may do some good things for the Trump administration and for the United States.
Well, Barbara, you've certainly made a distinction between Tillerson and John Bolton, who is known for being very hawkish. So do we know what Tillerson's views are?
Well, he's been promoted by Condi Rice, Bob Gates,
and the entire Bush family.
Basically, what's left of the mainstream Republican foreign policy establishment has promoted him. John Bolton, on the other hand, a former UN ambassador, former Undersecretary of State under George W. Bush, has a reputation as being extremely hawkish and, as one person put it, never met a problem that couldn't be solved by bombing it. So we will see who is named. I've heard names like Richard Haass and Mark Kimmett, who are also mainstream Republicans as possible deputy secretaries of state. The Trump administration is having trouble finding. They've reached out to some Democrats, reportedly, who've refused to serve. So, you know, we'll see. But there's time for that.
And what would the policy look like as compared to Obama's?
Well, that's a really good question because you have people like Tillerson and Jim Mattis at Defense who are pragmatic individuals. And then you have Mike Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who is, according to what I hear, extremely ill-informed about many things, has a very strong Islamophobic streak, very strong conspiratorial streak. And he's the man whispering into Trump's ear. So who in the end will, you know, shape the policy? I think that's a real question. So far, Trump seems to be spending most of his time renegotiating contracts for Pentagon procurement and antagonizing the Chinese. But we will see.
Abdi, what about that? We've seen these splits before between the National Security Advisor, who has the president's ear, and then there's the State Department, which is a few blocks away from the White House.
Yeah, and the splits could actually serve the president well in terms of giving him opposing views to choose from. The problem that arises in this particular case is that some of these people, as Barbara said, are not particularly well informed about the area of expertise that they are supposed to bring to the table. So ultimately, at least we have known Trump to be, he's a man of his own mind. He makes his own decisions, whether you give him an informed opinion or not. He will make the decision that he wants to make. Remains to see to what extent his entourage may be able to actually control that streak in him.
Well, that's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, correspondent for AlMonitor.com and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera TV. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thank you for listening.